This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
And good morning, Roger. Good morning to all of you as we come your way from our studio in Huntley, Illinois, where the temperature is 55 degrees. Somebody said, where is Huntley? Some of our distant listeners. Well, Huntley is on I-90, halfway between Rockford and Chicago. And I'm probably about half a mile away from a cornfield, and it's certainly not knee-high by the 4th of July. It is at least chest-high by the 4th of July, but then the knee-high went away a long time ago with the advancing use of technology in plant breeding that we have certainly seen. But 4th of July weekend, a special time for a lot of people, whether you're on the farm or in the city. As always, I caution our city listeners, if you're going driving in the country on roads that are not familiar, slow down, enjoy the scenery, because you never know, turning a curve or coming up over a hill, there could be a tractor and a tool being pulled by that tractor doing about 40 to 50 miles an hour slower speed than you are. And I'll tell you this, if you have a collision with a car that you're driving and a tractor and a tillage tool, you're going to lose. So be careful and watch for that slow-moving vehicle emblem sign, the triangular with the fluorescent red and orange. That is the symbol of a slow-moving piece of equipment. So that's my safety sermon every summer holiday weekend. And again, to our farm friends, don't use the slow-moving vehicle emblem as a driveway marker on a stationary post or mailbox. Legally, that is not the use of the slow-moving vehicle emblem. And just one other thing I wanted to note, since it's 4th of July weekend, growing up on the dairy farm in the hills of western Wisconsin, many of you have heard this story before, but the traditional start for quite a few years to the 4th of July holiday, our farm was on the ridge overlooking a valley. We had a bluff that we could go to and look right down over the valley of Brush Creek. Every 4th of July morning at about 5 o'clock before we'd milk the cows, Dad would take a stick of dynamite, walk out to the bluff, light it, throw it over the bluff. There was nobody, nothing directly below us. And you talk about a firecracker. That was the firecracker that was the symbol that the 4th of July was on in Brush Creek and the Kickapoo Valley of Wisconsin. There will be people, of course, enjoying the holiday weekend by gardening and taking care of things around the yard. And that's why we have Jim Fazell join us every week. Jim is standing by to talk about some things you can do if you want to work in the lawn, the yard, the garden. And he'll be joining us when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. It's Jim Fazell time here on the Saturday Morning Show, this big holiday weekend, and I hope you have good weather and good plans, Jim.
Well, I think the weather is going to be great, and we do have some plans. In fact, this is one of the weekends where we try to spend part of the three-day weekend getting the yard ready so that we can celebrate the holiday in good fashion. So there are plenty of things to do out in the yard on this long weekend, especially starting today. You want to get the garden in shape, and one of the first things I like to do, and I use the 4th of July, really, that weekend as a guideline for this, and that's to do some pruning of the shrubs out in the yard, the evergreens, the broadleaf ground cover shrubs and so forth, like the yews and the cotone asters. They've pretty well done their first flush of growth, and if you trim them right now, they'll stay in shape pretty well for the rest of the season. Incidentally, when you do this, don't go out there with the head shears and shear them. Use a pair of hand clippers or a pocket knife and some old garden hose on your fingers to protect them. Remove individual stems that are too long, overly long stems. If they're bigger than what you can cut with the hand clippers, then you may have to saw them off. But anyway, that's what you need to do at this time. Don't shear them, as I said, because it does destroy the normal shape of these plants, the forms of these plants. And if you're going to do shearing, keep it or restrict it to formal hedges. That's how you do them and how you keep them formally. With the broadleafed shrubs, things like lilacs and viburnums that flowered already, it's very important that you trim them now before they set flower buds for next year. Because if you wait for another couple, 3 weeks or a month to trim those things, the flower buds will already be set, and you're going to wonder next year why you didn't get any flowers. So that's the same thing there. You cut back some of the oldest stems, the longest stems, get the thing back into shape. Head the long ones back to a reasonable length. Shape the plants up for the rest of the season, and you can be sure if you do it now that you're going to have flowers next year. Out in the garden, cut the dead blooms off the annuals and the perennials as they begin to deteriorate. It keeps the garden looking neater. Hoe out the weeds from the flower beds, the shrub borders, and the vegetable garden as well. Mow and edge your lawn. You know, edging, a lot of people don't bother to edge, but edging is what can really sharpen up the looks of the lawn. And if you only do it once, this is probably the best time of year to do it, because the grass is going to slow down a little bit now that it's warmer, and we're probably not going to get as much moisture as we had earlier in the year. But anyway, this is the time to get that edged up around the trees and shrubs as well, and along the sidewalk and the curbs. Now, lawn insects. Now is the time, and we've talked about this before, now is the time to treat for these lawn insects. Sob webworms. The adults are flying now, and as they fly, the females lay eggs, which drop off into the lawn, and these eggs will hatch into little worms that feed on your grass. They'll eat the grass off at the base. They don't kill the grass, but they eat the leaves off so that you'll have bare spots in the lawn. About 10 days after you see the maximum flight of these things, that's when you need to spray. The maximum flight occurs as you're mowing the lawn. You see these little, maybe a half inch to inch long moths flying out ahead of the lawnmower, and they skitter out down back into the grass, and as you catch up with them, they do it over and over again. Well, when you see the maximum flight of that thing, then you go ahead and treat. Use something like 7 can be used, or Dilox, or Ortholawn Insect Killer works real well. Grubs, we've talked about them. The grub-preventing materials have been on the market for some time, and we've said, now don't treat yet because it's a little bit too early. The adults are just beginning to emerge, and these are the Japanese beetles and the June bugs and the masked shapers and so forth. The females dig into moist ground to lay eggs, so if your lawn is nice and green and moist, they're going to lay eggs in it. If it's dormant and brown right now, you probably don't have to worry about grubs. The eggs hatch a couple of weeks after they're laid, and these grubs begin to feed on the roots of the grass. So if you apply slow-release materials now, that stuff will be ready to go about the time these grubs really begin feeding. And what are these? They'd be things like imidacloprid, which is Merit, or Bayer Advanced Lawn Season Long Grub Control. I don't know where they get these names.
I don't either.
Grub X or High Yield Grub Killer. This is the time to put those things on. It takes 2, 3, maybe 4 weeks for them to really become active. They have to be picked up by the plants. So this is the time to do that. Now, if you don't get that stuff on, say, well, I'm probably not going to have grub damage, but later in August or September, you begin to see the grub damage show up. It's not too late to do anything. There's always a treatment that can be used then. Dilox works good at that time. But anyway, now is the time to put these slow-release materials on. And if you get them on, be sure that you put a little bit of moisture on them if we don't get rain, a quarter to a half an inch of water just to get that soaked down into the ground so it'll work. The lawn and garden weeds are really growing, and they're going to catch you unaware unless you go out. It's amazing after a week being gone how fast these things grow. Even if there's no rain, they seem to tolerate the dry weather beautifully. In your garden, hoe them out or pull them out. In the lawn, broadleaf herbicides can be used now, the weed and feed and so forth. And incidentally, we were just out walking earlier this week, and we noticed a tremendous amount, and it's actually in a park area, where people had killed the weeds in the cracks in the sidewalk, and they'd also killed about 3 feet of grass next to the cracks in the sidewalk from the drip. If you're going to use glyphosate, use it extremely carefully. Be sure that you use it on a cool day when it's not going to drip, and read the label before you use it. Now, I've noticed we had, I think, 2 inches of rain last week.
Whoa!
And we had a deluge one night last week. Anyway, we maybe it was a week ago. But anyway, the next morning we were out walking, and lo and behold, there were sprinklers running. So I want to just mention, turn the time clock off until the grass begins to wilt, then turn the clock on and let it go through its cycle. Turn the clock off again until the grass wilts again. Don't try watering your lawn with a handheld hose. That's probably not the way to do it. And don't waste the water on it if it doesn't need to be watered. Well, anyway, by this time you've got everything under control, so you're good to go for the holiday on Monday. Put up the flag, go to the parade, have a picnic or a barbecue, and enjoy the day with family and friends, Orion, and celebrate the 240th birthday of our great country.
Indeed we will, and I will do something agricultural the day before. I'll be going to Arlington Park Racetrack, and horses are agricultural, so I'll watch them do their thing. And then probably the best fireworks display in the Chicago area happens at Arlington when it gets dark, of course. So we're looking forward to doing that. One more thing I want you to touch on, because I still see it happening. People holding a garden hose, watering the grass for maybe 10, 15 minutes till it looks wet. Not a good idea?
Not a good idea. You actually need to put down a good inch of water. You need to have a sprinkler set to do that. If you're holding your garden hose, it puts out maybe 3 or 4 gallons a minute. Can you imagine how many gallons it would take? It takes about 250 gallons for a 10-by-10 area to get your good inch of water. Anyway, don't do it with a handheld hose. It's good for the soil, but it's not good for the grass. You need to water the grass deeply and well, and let it go until it begins to wilt.
All right, my friend. You and Jane have a great holiday weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, thanks, Orion.
Jim Fazell, our specialist in ornamental horticulture, here on the Saturday Morning Show. It is 20 minutes after 5 o'clock here on the Saturday Morning Show, WGN Radio, Chicago, and a lot going on this weekend. Whatever you're doing, we hope you enjoy it to the utmost. The races, fireworks at the Arlington track that I mentioned will take place tomorrow, Sunday. So tough to keep up with what day of the week it is with the holiday coming on Monday, but they'll be doing their fireworks display on Sunday evening. So we'll be there for that. And of course, markets will be closed on Monday, so there'll be no market reports for us to do. We're at 21 minutes after 5 now. It's 55 degrees in Huntley, Illinois, about the same at O'Hare Field, and a magnificent sunrise. My golly, if you haven't seen it, at least it's beautiful out my back window. And the only thing, the old saying, sky red at morning, sailors take warning. Who knows what could happen, but right now it looks like fairly dry weekend. It was a couple of weeks ago that we spent the morning on the Lindale Holstein Farm at Hampshire, Illinois, for the June Dairy Month breakfast, hosted by the Drendel family, had the opportunity to enjoy once again conversations with Dale and Linda Drendel, who operate the farm and who are in charge of the dairy operation. And after we were there and talked about it, several of you said, well, we couldn't get there. What was it like? So I'll share with you right now my conversation with Dale Drendel at Hampshire, Illinois.
Well, the dairy farm is actually, it consists of about 140 cows, including the dry cows. We're milking 125 right now. So, and then all the young stock is raised here on the farm. So, and then it's a total of about 650 acres. So, and we raise all of our own homegrown feed, other than buying some commercial protein and then cottonseed that we also feed.
So you've already harvested your first crop of hay, but we're also watching corn and other crops grow?
Right. You know, the first crop of hay, it was a little bit later this year because weather didn't quite cooperate with us here in northern Illinois. But the corn, actually, I didn't plant my first field of corn until the 19th of May, which I should have been doing hay already. But the corn is off to a great start. Usually I have about 400 acres of corn and soybeans and wheat, a little bit of oats.
Okay. Two questions, and you can respond in whichever order you want. Your biggest satisfaction, your biggest challenge, operating a dairy farm?
Well, obviously, a biggest satisfaction kind of a twofold thing. After seeing a day like this with this many people here, you're really pretty humbled that you can open the place up and help educate consumers on the what actually does happen on a dairy farm. And then the other really humbling thing is what we have accomplished on the farm here. Linda and I will be married 42 years next week. So, you know, what we've built up in those 42 years, you know, and we've done a lot of cattle showing throughout the years and, you know, having our children grow up, all being involved with agriculture. And primarily, if you want to still say, they still are involved with agriculture.
Well, besides raising cows, you have raised a fine family. How large a family?
Now, there's three children. Our oldest daughter, Carrie, works at Country Companies for Illinois Farm Bureau. Our son, Jeff, farms with us. And then our youngest daughter, Julie, she does a little bit of everything, but she's the past editor of the Holstein World, and then did some radio work and TV work, so which you got to meet her throughout the years. And she does her own website design, and whatever she can get into, she's not afraid to tackle it.
She has the technology knowledge, I take it.
Right.
Well, looking at my childhood on a dairy farm that was far different than this one, I think in all the time I was on that farm with the folks, they took 1 3-day vacation because cows have to be milked every day, and Dad said, I'm the only one that can milk them. So what's been the case with you? Do you get away from the farm?
Actually, yeah, in 42 years, you know, we spent a lot of time here, you know, primarily. We did have a little bit of family help early on. And then as our family started coming along, then we started hiring a little bit of help here and there. And then as time progressed on and we got a little bit larger, we got a little bit more help involved. And then Linda and I both, you know, she was a teacher, so, and I've been really involved with the dairy industry
right.
In all facets of it. So, you know, our vacations really never was a vacation. My vacations was basically going to farm meetings and anything that had to do with the dairy industry, really, which I've always enjoyed a lot and will probably always enjoy it. So I've always said it's the people you meet through the dairy industry are unlike any other people.
One final question. I've heard quite a few little kids today telling their parents they sat in the seat of a tractor because that's part of this beyond the cows and the barns.
Right. You know, we've sat in different pieces of equipment out there. You know, the big square baler is out there with the tractor in the front of it. The self-propelled chopper is out there. And then I guess we sat the tractor and the corn planter out there.
Right.
Just so they have a little bit of an idea of the size of perspective size of what this equipment is nowadays. And I guess I consider ourselves small in comparison to a lot of the larger farmers in the area.
Dale Drendel, along with his wife Linda, owners and operators of Lindale Holstein Farm at Hampshire, Illinois, that probably had nearly 2,000 people on the farm 2 weeks ago today to enjoy a farm breakfast and get a look at where the milk comes from that makes all of these fine dairy products, or thanks to them. Coming up to news time, but before we break for the news, I want to talk about an event that Gloria and I attended this week, the preview tour of the new Santegra Hospital in Huntley, Illinois. Now, the Del Webb community, actually, I'm living on what once was the Drendel Dairy Farm, but that was purchased back in the 90s by Del Webb, and now instead of dairy cows, there are 5,800 homes on the Del Webb Sun City in Huntley, and senior citizens 55 and over to live in the community. So several years ago, a lot of us in the community said it would be great to have a hospital a little bit closer to this facility. And on August 9th, they will open the Santegra Hospital Huntley. And we toured it along with quite a few other people who worked hard to get that hospital built in the community last Tuesday. And boy, you talk about a modern facility that, well, my wife, who was in the hotel business forever, said seems more like a hotel than a hospital. But when you take a look at what it takes to operate a modern hospital today, I guess you can understand why the cost of medical treatment in the hospital is as high as it is. I was on the board of trustees of Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge back in the late 70s, and I thought equipment was expensive at that time, but it was nothing compared to what we're looking at today. But a beautiful facility. I know they're going to be holding a few more open houses before the opening on August 9th. If you have an opportunity, whether you live in the community or not, it gives you a pretty good look at what it takes to build and maintain a modern hospital today. So hats off to the staff and to the board of directors at the hospital. People like Michael Easley, Chuck Ruth, Tom Hallett, Tom's Market. He sold the hospital, the land that it's built on, and so patients can look out the window and see sweet corn growing right next door at Tom Hallett's place, Tom's Market, on Algonquin Road. Coming up to the 5:30 news headlines, we had two major reports on Thursday affecting the grain market. That was the quarterly supply-demand report, giving us an idea of how much we have in the bin at the moment until we start harvesting the crop that is growing now. And then the other important report was planted acreage, because back in March, farmers gave us their planting intentions, and then the June 30th report always tells us what they actually planted. And there were some surprises in those numbers on Thursday, so we'll talk about that. Thank you, Roger. At 25 minutes before 6 o'clock, coming up, a visit with Paul Georgie of Allendale, based in McHenry, Illinois, discussing the numbers in those two reports that came out on Thursday. But before we get to that, we say welcome to Samuelson Says. I'm Orion Samuelson. This week, revisiting a topic that I discussed a few weeks ago, the one-room, eighth-grade country school. We'll get to that in a moment. But now let's talk about a product at Wink Products Company, because I'm sure one of your favorite appliances is your coffee maker, but that could produce coffee with a metallic taste, because mineral deposits that come into that coffee maker can do that. But you don't have to put up with it because of the Wink Products Company. They have the product that will make that coffee maker do what you want it to do. It's Wink Products Coffee Maker Cleaner, the perfect cleaning solution to remove those nasty mineral deposits that make your coffee taste metallic and cause your coffee maker to clog. So pick up Wink Coffee Maker Cleaner today. See what a difference it makes. You can learn more about that product and the family of products from the folks at Wink at WHINKWINK.com. And now, Samuelson Says. As we celebrate Independence Day this weekend, I thought it would be a good idea to go back to a unit that played an important role in educating and developing this country over the 240 years, the one-room, eighth-grade country school. You may recall a few weeks ago I talked about the one-room, eighth-grade country school that I attended in Wisconsin and wondered if there were many of them in existence today. Well, I should have known I would hear from a lot of Amish communities where they do have the one-room country school, but I want to share one letter today from Kalkaska, Michigan, that pretty well sums up the story of a school still in operation. The letter came from Donald Cotton of Kalkaska, Michigan, located a few miles east of Traverse City. He said, "I am sending you information on our one-room school. It is still serving our area. It is near Kalkaska, Excelsior District No. 1 Crawford School. It was formed in 1875, soon after the county and township were organized. The district was named for an early settler family, and there are still descendants of that early family in the district. The present building was built in 1892. Electricity was added when the REA came to the area about 1940, and LP gas replaced wood heat in 1951. Until the 1960s, one teacher had all kindergarten through eighth grades with 20 to 30 plus students. Beginning at that time, two or three teachers taught more students, and a recently retired teacher came to teach here as a young lady and retired 35 years later and ended up teaching the children of some of her former students. The woodshed has been remodeled as a playroom and then was changed to a third classroom. All teachers have degrees, with one having a master's degree. The school has several computers and its own bus, and it's still operating today. And thanks to Donald Cotton of Kalkaska, Michigan, for sharing that story of the school that he and his generation of family attended. So we still have that one-room country school. My thoughts on Samuelson Says.
With a postscript, because a couple of other letters of one-room schools that recently closed, or in a couple of cases still operating, reminded me of two other things in the O'Connell grade school that I attended in Wisconsin. We had a bell tower, and the bell would be rung to signal the start of classes. It would be rung to call the students in from recess to resume the classes. And the day at the one-room country school I attended always started with all students standing at their desk doing the Pledge of Allegiance. So thanks to all of you who did share some memories from one-room, eighth-grade country schools. Well, there's more to come here at 20 minutes before 6 o'clock here on the Saturday Morning Show on WGN Radio Chicago. And we're going to visit with Paul Georgie of Allendale when we continue on the Saturday Morning Show. Paul Georgie of Allendale, based in McHenry, Illinois, joined us in our studio on Thursday after the big June reports were issued to talk about the impact of the acreage and the grain stocks report. Any surprises for you, Paul?
Well, I think the surprise for the trade was certainly the larger corn acres than they had expected. Most in the trade were looking for a 700 million acre decrease in corn acres. And here we come in with, what was that, about a million or 400,000 acres more. So that's about a million acres shift than what the trade was expecting. It shouldn't excite people too much, though, because in our analysis, even at current yield, it would amount, a million acre shift in corn amounts to about 77 million acres to the bottom line, an increase in ending stocks. So that was certainly a surprise. I think the soybean number, you had to anticipate how much the trade thought was in the market already. A lot of people in the trade was thinking 2 million acres, 2.5 million acre increase. It only came in at like 1.5 increase. So that got the beans a little bit excited, thinking that we're not going to have enough beans to go around now. So it's going to take a few days to settle out. But the problem that we've got here is we're going into a long weekend. Yep. We don't start trading again till Tuesday morning. And then you've got weather forecasts that every trader is going to be looking at. Has there been any change? Is it going to be hot and later on in July? Is corn going to pollinate? The beans going to pod and so forth. So we've got several weeks of pretty exciting markets here, I think.
I was a little surprised by the immediate results on the trading floor. Soybeans considerably higher right after the report came out. Corn down, of course. But is that supply situation in soybeans the reason that we're seeing that?
I think so. I think the supply situation in soybeans is getting tighter and tighter. And at the pace that we're going and the direction we're going, we're continuing to see all this demand from China. And any disruption in bean yields could create some tightness in bean supplies, and that could continue to drive bean prices up. But I think the reaction after that report came because of the trade was expecting bigger numbers
right.
in yield and or in soybean plantings, and they weren't quite that big. And they were expecting all these acres to shift from corn to go to beans. That didn't happen. So I think, you know, we'll see how it settles out here in the next couple trading sessions.
Whenever we come to the 4th of July weekend, I'm reminded of 1988, the drought year where in June we watched prices in the grain market limit up, limit up, limit up. And I recall it vividly because on the 4th of July weekend, I was in England leading a tour of Case IH tractor owners to visit the plant over there. And all of them, of course, were in the market and were confident, since it didn't rain over the 4th of July weekend, we'd continue to see more limit up moves. And when the market opened after the 4th of July weekend, down limit 3 days in a row, and they're stunned. And I said, you're going to run out of buyers sooner or later. And apparently that's what happened then, but I'll never forget.
The sad thing is I've been in the business that long myself, so I do remember that as well. And I don't think we have quite that emotion going into this July 4th weekend, but we do have emotion. We've got, you know, how many more buyers can we have come into this market? And that's the thing that concerns me. When I look at can we get soybean prices back up to the $12 area or corn back to $4.50, this impact from the British vote of exiting the EU and that fallout that we have not seen yet causes a lot of investor money to not come back in the market or to stay in very protective risk-off type situations. So that we've lost that money or that enthusiasm, that fuel to drive this market higher. And that concerns me about how high we can go now. So what I'm telling my guys, we got to be prepared for excitement, but you also got to take advantage of selling this thing into rallies at this point in time.
Last week, the week before, we had the pig crop report, quarterly pig crop report, came in with some bigger numbers there as well. Will this report this week have much of an impact on cattle and hog prices?
I don't think so. I think the USDA grain report says that we've got a lot of grain around, so that's good. There's some profitability potential for the livestock producer on the input cost, the feed cost side of things. The bottom line for livestock producers, or especially hog producers, is China. They reduce their size of their herd so dramatically that they need pork. And the U.S. is certainly a market where they can get it from. And we have been exporting a lot of pork to China. And we can afford to continue to build our herds as long as China buys. The problem that we get into is, you know, like that day in July in 1988 in the soybean market, it's when China decides, well, we don't need any more of that. Now we're holding the bag on it, and we're going to have to consume it ourselves, and that could hurt prices. But I think that's some time down the road. But near term, I think we can afford to increase our sow herd and not hurt prices a whole lot for the next several quarters.
As we go through the growing season into harvest in South America, they'll be going to looking ahead to the planting season. Will this report have much of an impact on Argentina or Brazil planting?
Well, it might have impact there. If bean prices stay strong, you're going to see the prices in South America increase, and that's going to drive more planting soybeans. One of the big concerns right now is the Argentina situation. Just a report this week, one of the seed corn companies in Argentina said sales are up like 30%. I'm planting more corn than they did a year ago because they took the export tax off. So farmers are planting a lot more corn. That's going to amount to maybe 5 to 7 million metric tons more exports coming out of Argentina next year. So those are the kind of things that will impact U.S. farmers because of the incentive and the ability for these South American producers to continue to grow more crop. Now, the situation in Brazil is much more chaotic. Yeah. Because they've got a political system there that trying to find its way. Corn prices and corn basis and prices out of Brazil has come down to where they're now cheaper than U.S. corn because they caught themselves in a real tight situation, shipping out too much when harvest before harvest. So that's settling down. So the exchange rate of the currency, I think, is something we haven't talked about, but that's another factor that's going to impact that South America crop as much as anything.
One producer wanted to know if I thought Brexit would have a long-term effect on our commodity prices. I just don't see that happening because we're coming back.
Yeah, I don't think it has a long-term on commodity prices, on grain prices anyway. I think the currency wars that we've been having for a year or so now will probably pick up because it's the EU. If the EU currency continues to slide, that's going to have a negative effect on our export demand, and that could hurt because it'll, especially with the wheat that they're producing over there as well, some of it is feed quality, so that will go into the feed market instead of corn here in the world. So that could slow down some demand eventually, but the U.S. quality of corn and so forth is still a big advantage for a lot of buyers.
And looking beyond the July report to the crop report in August that I always consider to be the first big one, because up to this point we're dealing with history, but in August we'll deal with the numbers that we got this week on planted acreage and that sort of thing. So weather will probably be the big factor.
Weather is going to be a factor. Right now, if you look at the crop today, you would have to say that we're going to have 170, 172 bushel an acre average, which is going to be greater than the trend yield, and that's going to give us some massive corn production numbers. But you know, chances are we probably aren't going to have that. We're going to have average. We got dry spots now, the farmers that are struggling because they need rain. We got guys that are having the best crops ever. So that, I think, is weather is going to have the impact, and we're going to watch that very closely. That's going to make us very sensitive at the Chicago Board of Trade. So we're going to have price volatility, but we got to use that volatility in our favor as producers.
You have a great 4th of July holiday weekend, my friend.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure to be here.
Always a pleasure to visit with Paul Giorgi of Allendale, based in McHenry, Illinois. 5 minutes before 6 o'clock news time here on WGN Radio Chicago. And this 4th of July weekend in this part of the Midwest looking fairly pleasant and dry. But storms expected across southern portions of the Corn Belt this weekend should bring much-needed moisture from Kansas to the Ohio River Valley, potentially easing some crop stress ahead of a warm-up next week. Kyle Tapley, an agricultural meteorologist with MDA Weather Services, said the shower should produce 1 to 3 inches of rain across the southern portion of the Midwest, parts of Missouri receiving 4 to 5 inches, and those areas will certainly see an improvement in soil moisture. The 4th of July weekend, of course, is typically significant because corn in the Midwest is starting to pollinate, and that's the crucial phase in determining ultimate yield. Now, last Monday in the weekly crop progress reports, the Department of Agriculture rated 75% of the corn crop as good to excellent, but the U.S. Drought Monitor said about 27% of the Midwest is abnormally dry. Again, the numbers in those Thursday reports that I think surprised some people, just as a comparison, back in March when the survey was taken of farmers and the question was, how many acres of this crop will you plant? And then we get on Thursday the number of acres they actually planted. Well, here are the comparisons. Back in March, farmers said they would plant 93,600,000 acres to corn. The number of planted acreage Thursday came in at 94,148,000 acres. Back in March, they said they'd plant 82 million acres of soybeans, Well, they actually planted 83,688,000 acres of soybeans. So those numbers came in above expectations. They were expecting a decline in corn acres and a much bigger increase in soybean acres. Didn't happen. And then the grain stocks report came with stocks higher in corn, soybeans, and wheat. So some surprises, as we heard from Paul Giorgi in our visit with him. Now, the dates for the next reports, incidentally, a week from Tuesday, that's July 12th, we will get the July crop report. That's Tuesday, July 12th. But to me, the big crop report of the season will come in August, on Friday, August 12th, when we'll get a crop estimate based on actual acreage and growing weather. So that will be the next big report coming up. One other thing I wanted to mention, too, when we call on farmers to change the way they produce livestock and poultry and all that, you're going to pay more for it in order to make those changes. Brother-in-law, who lives here in the Chicagoland area but has grandchildren in San Francisco, traveled to San Francisco last week, and in an email, he loves to cook. He said, "I had to buy some cage-free eggs since it's illegal in California now to put hens in cages." He said, "I paid $5.99 a dozen. And before I left Chicago in a special, I got eggs for 49 cents a dozen at Woodman's." And he said he had to buy organic milk in San Francisco, $6.99 a gallon, compared to the $2.85 a gallon he paid at Woodman's. So just kind of keep in mind, when we change agricultural practices from what we're doing, it's going to cost more money, and as consumers, we need to be ready to pay that. Well, that's our time here on this Saturday morning. You have a great 4th of July weekend. Make it a safe one. And thank you for joining us here on Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.